I think this is way more than a toy. This is by far the best image generation model that I've seen today. And even if we look at the benchmarks, and I'm not a big fan of benchmarks, as you know, but even when you look at those benchmarks, it is 200 sort of ELO points ahead of everything else.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of people pushing the frontiers of technology to discuss, debate, and analyze our way through the wildly fast-paced world of artificial intelligence. Today, I'm joined by a great crew of veterans and also someone joining for the very first time. I've got Aaron Botman, IBM Fellow, Master Inventor. Aaron, welcome back to the show. Chris Hay, distinguished engineer and longtime MOE veteran. And joining us for the very first time is Lauren McHugh, Program Director, AI Open Innovation. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So we've got a packed episode today. We're going to talk about OpenAI hinting that they might sell infrastructure, Nano Banana, the US Open. We're going to even talk about 100-page prompts coming out of KPMG. But first, as always, we've got our news segment from Eile. So Eile, over to you.
Hey, everyone. I'm Eile McConnon. I'm a tech news writer with IBM Think. I'm here now with a few AI headlines you may have missed this busy week. First up, NVIDIA, the world's most valuable company by market cap, reported a whopping 56% increase in sales over the same period from last year. And this was largely driven by its data center business. This would seem like good news for the chipmaker, right? In fact, market reaction was mixed because the revenues did not meet analyst expectations. Next up, OpenAI and Anthropic, two of the biggest rivals in artificial intelligence, have actually teamed up to better understand the security issues facing models. They recently evaluated each other's models in order to better understand hallucinations and other issues, basically hoping to catch what their own tests had missed. Meanwhile, in the category of helpful AI, many 911 centers are so understaffed that they're turning to AI to help them out. This may seem problematic on first blush, but actually, these AI agents are helping with parking violations, noise complaints, basically non-urgent issues, so that the human AI staffers can deal with the real emergencies. Last but not least, IBM and NASA are helping give scientists more time to prepare before big storms hit. They recently released a new open source foundation model called Surya that can predict solar flares that might interrupt satellites, power grids, and GPS. Want to dive deeper into any of these topics? Subscribe to our Think newsletter. The link is in the show notes.
So normally here at MOE, we cover some of the biggest stories happening in AI technology. You know, the drops of all the largest models coming out of the frontier model companies, the biggest features and products that people are launching. But I actually want to start today with kind of a funny, smaller story. There was an article that was written about KPMG, the kind of global accounting firm, which kind of launched their own, as many companies and enterprise are doing now, their own AI agent, which they call TaxBot. And what TaxBot is attempting to do is gather together all of the tax advice expertise across a big firm like KPMG and essentially strip through documents and generate sort of 25-page kind of advisory opinions for their customers that basically are like kind of the first draft of what they would typically provide for a client. And this would normally be a very normal story. Lots and lots of companies are doing this now. But this was the really funny thing. They took a lot of flack. I don't know if flack's the right word, but they got a lot of attention online because they sort of revealed that in order to power TaxBot, they had a 100-page prompt running behind this, which I think just as someone who, you know, kind of comes from a world where prompting is like a few sentences, this is like really remarkable. And so maybe, Aaron, I'll start with you. Is like, what's the longest prompt you've ever written? And is it kind of surprising to see like 100-page prompts, like novel length, novella length prompts coming out?
Yeah, well, first I got to say, you know, growing up, and this might, you know, give you my age a little bit, but I used to use these yellow books called Cliff Notes, you know, where where I could go pick it up from like Barnes and Noble, right? Or even buy it from Amazon and get cliff notes about a book. Well, we certainly don't need those anymore, right? Because we can use these large prompts, right, to summarize. But the largest prompt that I've ever written, I would say semi-written, right? Because I just copy-paste a manual, right, into the context. So it was probably about 40 pages, right, that I inputted into a model. And it came out, you know, with key points that were summarized. So it was very effective and really interesting how it worked. And it surprised me.
And I think it's kind of the interesting thing. So, and I guess maybe, Lauren, do you want to jump in on this? Is, you know, I know a narrative that was very prominent maybe a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, a long time ago in AI time, was like prompt engineering is going to be dead over the long run. We're not going to really need prompt engineering. You're going to just tell the computer what you want. It will do it. This kind of story almost points us in a different direction, right? It's like almost a world in which, in order to get agent behavior to be really, really good, there's going to have to be like a lot of specification. And in some sense, like prompt engineering is like becoming a bigger part of what gets these things to work. Is that the right way of thinking about it? Like, did it turn out that prompt engineering was not actually dead?
I think a good way to appreciate how complex a prompt would be to look at some of the open source projects that are essentially agents. So GPT Researcher, MetaGPT, you can see how long and complex those prompts are. And that's been, you know, a whole community's worth of contribution of ideas of how to make the agent work better. I do think that, you know, if a product requires a 100-page user manual to work, that, you know, at best, it's poorly designed. At worst, it's broken. And in this case, the product is the model. The right. user manual is the prompt. So one thing that you could do is actually fine-tune it. I think fine-tuning probably is making a comeback, especially with some of the models like Gemma 3 to 70 million, where the actual architecture is made to be tuned. You know, more parameters allocated to the embedding versus parameters allocated to the transformer blocks to do the processing.
Part of it, I think, is like, it actually goes to Aaron's original example, which is, I think, like, what's prompting exactly? You know, I think prompting sometimes can just mean like the input to the model, in which case it's maybe no surprise that you put in like a whole manual to try to get it to summarize. Here, I'm curious if like there's a reason why these prompts need to get super long in the tax domain. Is there something about like agents that require us to have longer prompts? Or do you think this is just kind of like a weird artifact of how they designs this tax bot, basically?
I think it, like, my main question would be, out of those 100 pages, how many of those pages need to be rewritten for a new use case? That, you know, that only KPMG knows. And that would get to the heart of how much of this is, you know, because it's an agent and any agent would need to do that. And then how much of this is truly a custom solution, which is then a lot harder to scale.
Yeah, there's a really interesting dynamic there. And I guess maybe, Chris, I'll bring you in on this. I think what, Lauren, what I hear you sort of saying is that, like, in some ways you have these really long prompts to make up for all the knowledge that the model doesn't know. And so I guess, Chris, maybe there's one point of view is that as these models get deployed in more and more specialized domains, it's not going to be atypical to see really, really long prompts emerge, right? Because in effect, there's all this domain knowledge that like a general model might not have. I suppose there's the original idea that the base model would just get smart enough that you wouldn't have to do that. But I mean, if this is a good example, we may not be headed in that direction.
I'm not surprised, though. I think 100 pages, you know, I mean, as long as 99 of those pages aren't, you know, do not hallucinate and repeat, then... then
it's,
I think,
actually like The Shining. It's just the same sentence over and over and over again.
Exactly. But to Lauren's point, right? If the model doesn't have the knowledge in the first place and you've got a lot of specialist domain, then you're going to have to put that into context. And I'm not against it, because we've all been using retrieval augmented generation for a while. And if you really think what's going on with RAG, you're doing a search and then essentially you're going to bring the relevant passages into your context anyway. So... in some regards, how is that any different? Really, what you're saying is, actually, I can fit everything that I need into the context window, and therefore the model's going to stand a better chance. And, you know, and I have to admit, I would probably rather have it in the context window than, you know, sort of rolling the dice at RAG and hoping that it gets the right chunk coming back. So it goes either way. But yeah, you are making up for lack of knowledge, or there's certain patterns that you want it to do. I need it. If you're generating a 25-page document and that 25-page document's got to look in an exact way, you're to Aaron's earlier point, you're building a specification, and the model's not a mind reader. It's got to produce it in the way that you want. And a good prompt is going to have examples. This is section one. This is section two. I want you to do this. Do not talk about this. This is your tone. Very quickly, that's going to get very, very large. So, and yeah, you can fine tune it, but fine tuning is really hard. So, you know, again, if you can stuff it in the context, that's fine. What I would probably say is I think this is, and I probably challenge their use of agent in this case. I suspect it's just a prompt. But I think if it was truly, truly agentic, I would argue that the agent would be able to go round and round the loop a few times. And I don't think you would need a 100-page prompt in that sense. And you could have the agent pull the elements that it needs and then bring together that structure in a way. Now, in reality, it probably ends up still about 100 pages, but I think it's rather than stuffing into the context window, you're having the agent go search and then bring everything together. So I challenge the word agent in this case, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wanted to just jump in and make 2 points, if I could, very quickly, as to why you would want to use a 100-page prompt. So to me, it seems as though these real-time systems, right, because the data is updated in real time, it's never going to be within, the knowledge base of the foundational model that you have, So if you think the stock market, and you want to ask questions, about what's happening today or this minute, then you need to get that information within a prompt. And you can get a lot of information very quickly within a prompt. And then perhaps you even add in like a persona. All right. So, and then the second use case that I was thinking about is, why you'd want to use this kind of a prompt, even if the data were in, the foundational model is if you think of like a flashlight, when you put content within a prompt, you're telling the system, focus in, right, on this type of data rather than hoping and rolling the dice, like Chris mentioned, that you're going to get that information back, right, as a result. But I would pair that with, like an Alora technique, where you can determine what the attention mechanism needs to focus in on, right? So if you pair the Alora technique, with a large prompt, then I think in turn, you'll be able to really take that flashlight when you're in the dark and light up exactly what you're looking for.
And Aaron, how do you plan to explain that to an accountant to do, as opposed to copy and pasting into a prompt?
Yeah, so in accounting, it's important, I think, because, lots of these different types of rules and regulations, it changes really quickly, and so if they're trying, like tax, right, in this case, I think it's important to, now I don't exactly know what was in the prompt, right, in this 100-page prompt, but I would hope, that it was mostly about rules, regulations, so that they could better understand and advise maybe somebody, right around what's happening. But in that tax, that's what I would think and sort of help out, a tax auditor.
That's one of the reasons I think like prompting is kind of, it's unbeaten, even though it's considered like a little bit of like a cheap way of doing things for people who are like much more in the machine learning world, is like for an accountant, like they're not going to go through some fine tuning, process. They would much rather just type stuff in and see things happen. And so it's like really hard to beat the fact that like the feedback loop on prompting is just so satisfying in a way that like is really hard for other methods of, AI alignment to basically work. Chris, do you want to jump in there?
No, I agree with you 100%, but I would love to see some accountants sitting there going, why should I be using QLORA here? How am I going to de-bias my data set here? Or you're an expert tax advisor. Please use Australian language in the response. Do not hesitate. Here are the tax codes.
That's right.
Yeah. I think what's kind of scary too is the whole idea of sentient, is that whenever you start adding in different personalities, if you're a media company and you want to, create, maybe very entertaining broadcasting, it seems like it's a real human, right? But that's another thread, right? If we wanted to pull in on it, but these large context and prompts combined with a lot of these other, if you abstract those internals, that Chris was mentioning away from the user, so it's very simple, it really is very powerful. Like the Comet browser, for example, you can do a lot of that. I'm very excited, right, about what's in store.
I also think it's important to keep in mind that the feedback loop is very quick on prompt engineering for end users. But in this case, I actually consider the prompt engineer to be, I'm sure, a AI ML team within KPMG that wrote that as the prompt for then others to just use in a more abstracted way. And so while a user might want prompt engineering for that super satisfying, quick feedback on nudging a model to do the right thing, you know, the actual team building this agent might have a, you know, more longer term view of, if I could actually make it simpler to do the prompt in the first place, then I could use this not just for tax, but they have other lines of businesses as well. So I think there's a difference in the level of patience and how much pain those two different groups would take on. And I actually think the group that probably actually wrote this 100-page prompt that then gets abstracted to the user might be pretty interested in the ways that they can make that prompt simpler and reusable over the fact that more prompt engineering is just going to get them quick results.
The other thing that's in my mind is, like, I remember in the article that it was like from 2024. And I just worry that, like, needle in the haystack stuff hadn't really been figured out properly in 2024. So I'm just wondering if like, all, you know, it's 100 pages, but actually the model's probably just looking at the beginning and at the end and then ignoring everything in the middle anyway. And they're just like tacking stuff on at the end and going, please work, and repeat. I don't know. But I mean, I suspect these days it's going to work a lot better, right? Because the models have been tuned to handle needle in the haystack stuff a lot better. But 2024, I think it's probably quite impressive.
Yeah. I mean, these models can handle up to like, what is it, like 128,000 tokens, right? I mean, that's big, right? And they're getting bigger and bigger. You know, it's, you can take an entire book, get it summarized. You know, that's why I jokingly said at the beginning, you know, I don't need these cliff notes anymore because I can get a model to summarize an entire book.
Yeah. And I think we will see that as basically just like, as the window gets bigger and bigger, you can just, you know, completely zero brain cell, just put the entire thing in and just see what happens. All right. I'm going to move us on to our next topic. So the next story we want to cover, today was sort of an interesting comment, really an offhand comment from OpenAI's CFO that got like a lot of play online. And I think it's a pretty interesting one. I kind of want to explain, talk through, especially for our listeners, like why it's happening. So basically, OpenAI's CFO confirms this thing that they were thinking about, not immediate, but maybe something that OpenAI might do down the line. And what they might do is basically get into the infrastructure game. So, you know, rather than going to a Google Cloud platform or an AWS, you would simply like get compute from OpenAI. It's sort of an interesting thing because that's very different from, you know, what OpenAI's business model has been to date, right? Which is basically selling access to its models. This would be it selling access to its underlying infrastructure that it's building up. And this is partially inspired actually by Amazon, right? Where the model that gave rise to AWS was, hey, we run all this massive infrastructure for our e-commerce business. Maybe we just rent that underlying infrastructure itself. So I guess, Lauren, maybe I'll turn it to you. Why would OpenAI want to do something like this? It kind of feels like in some ways, like these computing centers have been like the crown jewel. They don't want anyone to get access to it. It's how they pull off, you know, the massive pre-training runs that get you a GPT. But it kind of sounds like here they're now saying, well, you know, maybe not immediately, but we wouldn't mind renting that to some people. It seems like kind of a change of direction, don't you think?
So I could see this actually being like a foreshadowing to there being a market around secondhand GPUs or last season's GPUs. So we can take for granted that OpenAI has to use the latest GPUs to be competitive, like performance efficiency for research, for commercial offerings. And the release pace of that has been about every 2 years. So 4 years ago, we had A100s. 2 years ago, we had H100s. This year, we had Blackwell. So every 2 years, they have to refresh their whole fleet. Yet the actual lifespan of these GPUs is like 5 years, could be seven.
They're still like sitting around.
Years, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they won't be good enough, you know, at year three for OpenAI to use in their research, but could be perfectly good enough for a customer who, you know, is running large scale inference workloads. So I could see it as a way to recoup that investment, especially with the CEO saying that they could be making trillions of dollars in investment in more infrastructure, that, you know, after 2 years, they have to find a way to not use themselves, but, you know, figure out if there's customers who want them.
Yeah, that's right. And Chris, I guess this is like, it's kind of remarkable because, yeah, Lauren, I read the article in very much the same way where I was like, oh, yeah. Like every time they build one of these big data centers, it's like the biggest data center that has ever data centered. And then kind of what they're saying here is like, but yeah, in 24 months, it's going to be kind of obsolete for us. And like, we need to sell it to other people. Like, Chris, I guess the pace of computing progress here is like kind of insane, right? Like that basically the cutting edge becomes not fit for purpose for these frontier model companies within the span of a year. Like there's like, you know, this is like the time period here is like very, very small.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it really just comes down to economics, as you sort of say there, right? Which is if it's cheaper to run the latest GPU as opposed to an older version, and you're going to be able to get your training runs done, then there's going to be a value. So, you know, you need to stay ahead in that sense. So I guess it makes sense to be able to rent that stuff out. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, don't want to rent out Sam Altman's grotty old unused GPUs. No, I want the shiny things. You know what I mean? I think it makes a lot of sense. Like, you know, as you say, AWS does that, right? And they need the GPUs probably, even today, they need it the most when they're doing the big training runs. But then inference is just taking over. And then as we start to look at what's happening in inference, right, the chips are kind of getting much, much smaller. They're specialized inference chips now. So you're not even using the Blackwell's H100s, you know, arguably for inference. There's a lot of providers, if you think of things like Grok, for example, you know, they're using specialized chips in that sense. So you're not even passing it off over there. So yeah, I mean, what are you going to do with that? And so even if you've got the latest Blackwell or the whatever the next version after that is going to be, then when you're not doing the big training runs, then, you know, you've got spare capacity that you want to be able to sell off. And now that becomes great for us, because if you want to know when to train in the next model, just have a look at the spot models. And if there's none available, you know what's happening.
Yeah, that's a good tip for the future. Aaron, I guess question for you is like, can OpenAI win in this space? Like, to chat are offering these kinds of services, they're going to be going up against some pretty big players. And I guess the kind of question is like, do you have confidence that OpenAI can just kind of flip a business like this on?
Well, I guess my first thought, you know, when I was looking into this is today, it seems as though OpenAI is very deeply dependent on Azure, right? And so, you know, for compute and even distribution of their models, but it seems as though in the long run, OpenAI, they seem to be exploring, building their own infrastructure, which would then almost like rebalance, you know, this from a dependency that they have to a collaboration, maybe a collaboration, right? And so that I think strategically is what potentially could be happening here, right? Yeah, and is it a good thing, and can they do this? Well, I think so. I would just be careful because I know that they've also, you know, released or said that they want to have, you know, this consulting, you know, area, you know, where they're going to charge, what is it, like $10 million per client, right, to help them, you know, user models. So, I mean, that's a big area, focus area that they have to work on. They're still building models, right? And now they want to do hardware. That's three separate sort of tenets, right, that they have, you know, and they don't want to fragment themselves too much to get away from their bread and butter, you know. But if they can be successful and put it all together, then I think OpenAI can pull it off. And it'd be a nice reorganization of the current business landscape.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. It's just like how much, like, you know, every few months, it feels like OpenAI is launching a new product line. Maybe that's actually creating a bunch of spread. Lauren, was that you wanted to jump in?
I was going to say, I think in terms of whether they can win, one question is, could they win against other companies doing this? The other question is, could they win against open source? So VLLM is very popular. TensorRT LLM is also quite popular. And those are really the core technologies you would need to set up your own deployment rather than just, you know, use a hosted API. And I think there'd have to be a really strong case around either better performance, better usability, better something than these like very, very popular open source projects where a lot of the inference optimization, other innovations are very quickly showing up in those engines because it has a whole community's worth of contribution happening in like almost real time.
Yeah, that's really interesting. We've talked about obviously the pressure that OpenAI has had on like the model side from open source. You're almost saying that this actually goes a level deeper, right? Is like, can it produce an inference stack and infrastructure business that's competitive with what's happening in open source? I hadn't really even thought about that. It's really interesting.
Yeah. I kind of wonder if this is a hedge, you know, because they just released their open weight models, right? And so because they're sort of doing some of that work, if they can build out this specialized infrastructure that's better than anyone else, then perhaps, you know, this is where they think the market is going, right? So that they can still remain financially solvent.
Right. Yeah. Even as the model price comes down, you're like trying to capture it on the infrastructure side. That's really interesting.
Yeah. What I didn't see was their financials about how they're going to fund, you know, this like $1 trillion investment to build their own data center. So I'd be interested to see some of that whenever it comes out.
All right. I'm going to move us on to our next topic today. It was very funny. We had prepared this segment all to focus on the ins and outs of a very detailed economic study that came out about jobs and AI. And we will cover it on a future episode. But as so happens so frequently in the world of AI, Nano Banana launched. And that obviously has taken up a lot more airtime in AI world. And I think it's worth going into. So we're going to, instead, rather than talking about AI economics and the labor market, we're going to talk about Nano Banana. Chris, I think you are one of the strongest advocates for switching out topics so we could talk about Nano Banana. I think the question for you is, how big of a deal is this? Like, it seems in some ways that it's kind of just like a toy, right? Like you put an image in and swap a person out and all that kind of stuff. Talk to us a little bit about like what's going on beneath the hood and whether or not this is significant from a kind of research and technological capability standpoint.
Okay, so I think the first thing to say is I think this is way more than a toy. This is by far the best image generation model that I've seen to date. So, and even if we look at the benchmarks, when we look at, and I'm not a big fan of benchmarks, as you know, but even when you look at those benchmarks, it is 200 sort of ELO points ahead of everything else, right? So it is absolutely just killing it. And what is super cool about it is, to your point, Tim, is the quality from the model is great. The text capabilities of the model is great. So if you typically look at an image model, you know, it'll mess up the text and all that side of things, and it doesn't look great. The quality is just amazing. And then to your point, it's like the ability to hold an image and then put that image in different spaces, maintain the physics, et cetera, is absolutely brilliant. So to your point, you can face swap, you can add a smile, you can make a change, you can put somebody in a different location. It all works great. In fact, if we can I share my screen, Tim? Can I share my screen?
I believe, yeah, the permissions are open if you want to share your screen.
So for all of the wonderful users here, whilst I was supposed to be paying attention to the podcast.
This is what Chris is usually doing when he's listening to everybody else talk.
Yeah, exactly. This is what I built instead. Wait a minute. Let's see. So we'll see here. Let's get rid of this. So I said, put Tim in a banana suit. There's Tim, screenshotted from today's podcast. And then there's Tim, right? And he didn't look very happy. Oh, sad. No. Tim in a banana suit. Make Tim happy in a banana suit. And there he's got a nice, happy face. And I said he's going to be happy because he's in Miami Beach.
Banana Beach, very nice.
There's Tim. And then I said, oh no, he needs a friend with him and an apple suit. Sorry, Lauren, I didn't get your permission. There we go. And Tim and Lauren are in Miami Beach, happy. So, we're joking around. I'll stop sharing my screen now. We're joking around.
Thank
there.
You, Chris.
But the reality is that is fantastic. Getting any of the other models to be able to do it to that quality, and it does all the cell transferences, as you imagine. Now, if you start to think of the impact of that, everything from creation of YouTube thumbnails to, you know, image editing, filtering, all the sort of things that you would have typically done with kind of Photoshop type stuff, then, you know, think of things like Canva, for example. You would typically, I mean, I use Canva a lot. What's going to happen there, right? Because you're going to start to be able to just use this, out of the box from Google AI Studio. I honestly think it is phenomenal. And I really think there's going to be a lot of people who've invested in image models really sort of starting to panic very quickly.
And I do want to pick up on that point. Aaron, I think one of the narratives that has kind of played out in a very interesting way over the last year or so has been, I think had you asked me January 2025, you would have been like, who's leading in this AI space? Been like, OpenAI, Anthropic, and then Google is like kind of at the very end of the list. Like, oh man, they just do not have their act together. But kind of announcement by announcement, they really seem to be catching up in a really pretty significant way. And so I guess, Aaron, I just wanted to kind of for you to reflect a little bit on, you know, do you think that this is like, in some ways, like this is kind of like Google really kind of like fighting for first now in some respects, particularly on the image side?
Well, I never thought I'd see Lauren in an Apple suit, you know, that's for sure, right? And I think that's pretty impressive. As far as what is, you know, sort of this jump forward, I really like this multi-turn editing capability where it can remember and build upon prior instructions that you already gave it, you know, and that's an indicator of like some kind of extended attention and memory capabilities within the model, you know, which sort of propels it up, right? The projection of some of the best image generation models. And I think some of the other pieces are this, you know, it has like up to 1 million tokens, right, that you can put in. So because you have to be able to put in like a text prompt and then also add in an image, right? And so all those things, you know, and then also seeing Tim in a banana suit, I think that definitely propels it up to the number one image generation system out there.
Lauren, I guess we can use the opportunity, I think, to have you on the show because, you know, I think you've already brought it up a couple times as like the kind of like ever-present influence of open source on this space. And it's certainly for language models and text, it feels like open source is kind of, you know, kind of like in the running for state of the art. Where are we, you feel, on kind of like open source image and kind of other forms of media generation? Is that similar in the space from your perspective where like open source is really kind of catching up very quickly, or is it a place where, you know, the space is still lagging?
Yeah, I think on the models front, it's maybe not as important as on the inference engine and then even like the user interface front, because you need all of those pieces to come together. And the inference engines are typically more skewed towards text use cases. So I think even if the models are up to par, it's not the same as being able to go to that user interface that Chris just showed, which was probably free, or at least a free tier. There's not really the equivalent in open source. There's always going to be that element of, you know, DIY-ness that you have to do to first find the model. And then the model might not be as generalizable. There might be, there are certainly, if you look at Hugging Face, I think it's millions of models at this point. So you could find models that are good at specific tasks, not so sure about as generalizable as what we just saw.
Chris, a final question on this is, it's the inevitable question. But we've been freaking out all the time for years at this point on how AI-generated images are going to destroy our ability to know what's real and what's not. Have we finally crossed the threshold with Nano Banana? This is, like, pretty good.
What's real anyway, Tim? We're all living in a simulation, so it's fine. Now, I actually think the progression here is really good, right? So I actually think the fact that we've been seeing terrible image models for a while has been a very good thing. And we've all got pretty good at spotting, I like the hands slightly off, you know. Yeah, so I think over the last few years, we've kind of got used to it. And we now know not to trust images. Do you know what I mean? So I think if you think of all of the kind of the Flux stuff with Black Forest last year, that was a perfect example. We saw all our politicians holding hands, doing whatever, right? We've got used to it. We know not to trust these models and the outputs. I think the bigger thing in this case is making sure that we hold people accountable for the models that they can create and making sure that the safety elements of those models are high, because, you know, it's, you know, there's a good side. People like me who couldn't create a thumbnail, great. I'm now going to be able to create decent thumbnails for my YouTube channel, plug. But for others, it means they're going to lose business in that sense. And then there's a whole lot of scary scenarios there. So I think there is still a lot of the ethical side that needs to to be worked out, but the quality is great. And it's just going to get better, right? And actually, one of the things I would say is we're seeing this right now for image. We can guarantee if we project forward 12 to 18 months, you're going to see the same level of quality on video. You're going to see the same level of quality on audio as well. So this is just going to extend out across modalities.
And I'll add too that I think this being such an editing focused model, editing has kind of become a bad word because it, you know, editing means manipulation, means like malicious intent. But there are really important use cases for editing. So like with the geospatial models that we built with NASA, one of the biggest struggles is cloud cover, you know, that most of the images, satellite imagery has cloud cover. So you can't do anything with that. And if you could do actually synthetically generated data using an editing model to then improve your data set to train a foundation model, that's an editing use case. And it's, you know, it's not about manipulation or changing the meaning of something from a human perspective. It's more for a machine learning perspective.
That's right.
And sure. And yeah, just being able to see Tim smile as well is really important. So.
As you know, I never smile on these shows. So. All right, so last topic of the day. Aaron, it's always a joke that when we bring you onto the show, we're going to talk about sports. And I'm not going to let us break the tradition here on episode 70. So you've been covering the US Open, and I think the team's been doing some interesting experiments. And so we've been doing a lot of screen sharing on this episode. I believe you want to kind of share some of the stuff that you've been doing as well.
Yeah, so I mean, first, you know, if I could just give a prelude as far as, you know, what we're doing. So, I mean, we've been with the US Open for over 30 years, right? And there's about a million fans that show up, right, and attend, you know, the Flushing Meadows site. And then every single day about, there's what, another 14 million fans that tune in through our digital properties. And what we've done, right, is we've been, the hallmarks, right, of the US Open is where we want to combine the fan experience with technology, right, so that we can bring in people, expand the swath of what we're doing. And we've introduced three new features this year. So one of them is a match chat. So we spent several months, you know, building this very impressive system, and we'll have a few papers, you know, out that describe, you know, the science behind it. But what this is, it's a real time sort of agent driven assistant, so that you can go in and ask a question about a match, about players, in real time, right, large scale, and get a response back, right. And then the second piece is called key points. Right. So we always say too long, didn't read, TLDR, right? You see that a lot, but there's these very long articles that people just don't have the time to read. And so we summarize it, right? And then we show those bullet points right on top of these articles. And we have a workflow of which, you know, we work with USTA editors. And then the third one is called live likelihood to win, right? This has a very long historical background, but, you know, we combine predictive modeling. So we have an ensemble of different predictive modeling that then go into who's going to win, right, the match. So we have a pre-match prediction, and then as the match goes on, we have some proprietary equations that we develop that then fine-tune and change, right, the odds that somebody's going to win, given these momentum. But ultimately, what we want to do is increase the breadth and depth, right, of fans and give them the information that they need so that they can understand the story of a match. And what I was hoping to do was continue this trend of experimentation of screen share, right, and just show you some of the work here that we've done. And it's live right now, and play starts pretty soon, right? So it's 10:47 right now, so it starts at around 11 o'clock, right? And we can go ahead and see some of the action. So just to orient you, you know, this is our work that we put together, right, that shows this is a website experience, right? And then obviously we have a very nice mobile app, right, that's a twin, right, of this. And I want to just quickly show you, you know, when a user comes in, what's one of the first things they want to know? Well, they want to know the scores, right, of a match. And so I would like to highlight two matches. One of them, right, was a big upset. So her name is Ila, right, and she's a 20-year-old, you know, from the Philippines, and she beat, right, Tucson, right? That's one, right? And then another is the Alcaraz match that I also want to show you. And let's check out the Alcaraz match here. So what you do is you, because this is already finished, right? But imagine, you know, play is going on and there's a match that's going on, which you can check later in the day. But let's check out the match recap. So we have, you know, the IBM Slam Tracker. and it pops up. And you can quickly see on the sidecar that we have the first tile would be the score here, right? And then when you go down, we have this 360-degree storytelling, right, of the match. And if you want to know beforehand, right, if the match hadn't started, what's the likelihood that Alcaraz is going to win? Well, it's pretty high, right, in this case. Right, this is round, a very early round. So this is what round two, right, and Alcaraz is off to a strong start. But this is what we've assigned, you know, that Alcaraz has an 82% chance of winning. And again, this uses pure predictive modeling that we've experimented with over years and years. Now, because the match is over, we can go to the summary tab, right? And you can see the live likelihood to win, you know, how it's changed over time, right? And there weren't very many fluctuations in this one because Alcaraz, you know, had a very big, you know, advantage whenever he came in, right? But now if I want to know some details, so this is Match Chat. This is one of the industry's first, again, I'm going to say, you know, large scale, right, real-time system, right? And so let's just click it, and it opens up. And we have a frictionless user experience that we've designed, you know, so that we can sort of guide the user and to help them get the information that matters the most. And we did a lot of user studying. We did a lot of data analytics to figure out, you know, what do people care about? So let's check out, I find Match Stats very interesting, right? So let's just ask a question. Let's say, how many aces let's put a player that isn't even in this match that Sinner have. And so let's do this first. So it's thinking, right? It's going through and it's hitting the pieces, right? And so what it first says is, wait a minute, do you want to know set by set or do you want to know about the match? And let's hit no, right? So because I want to know about the match here. And so now it's thinking again, analyzing, and this is going out, right? Real time right now. It's hitting our middleware, going out into AWS. And what it does is it then in turn comes back and tells us how many, you know, serves did Alcaraz have, right? And it worked well because it was able to switch, right, center, right, into the right players that it has. So it automatically does a lot of the detection. So we do have a lot of hat pipelines, and then it does pronoun corrections, it does player corrections, and so on, right? But you can play with this more as you go through, right, and see what all we've built. But it's very interesting, and there's a lot of deep statistics, right, that come in. And so, you know, if we were to keep going, then, you know, you can see lots of stats that people really want to know about. But in the interest of time, let's just go back and close this, right? And, you know, why don't you pick a match here on the screen rather than me picking a match, Tim?
Let's do the Harris versus Fritz there on the bottom right.
On the bottom right. So, okay, this one here. All right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, here, the pre-likelihood to win, let's check that out. I mean, Fritz was overwhelmingly the favorite, right? And so because of that, whenever you go and look at the live likelihood to win, if we trace it with the actual match, right, you can see that Fritz lost the first set, right? So his odds of winning, it goes down, but not that much because he's still favored so heavily. And then the story telling keeps going on where it's a very close one. It gives him the break points, right, in the second set, right? And because Fritz wins, well, you know, I think he's regaining the momentum, right? And then the match continues, right, where finally set four, you know, he eventually takes that over. So this live likelihood to win is really powerful during the match itself because you can track and trace how that works. You know, so that's that in essence is what I really wanted to show, you know, some of the exciting work, right, that's live right now. And then a plugin, you know, for our ESPN Fantasy Football, we went live with a few other pieces yesterday. And then next week on Wednesday, we're going to have another piece that's live. But if you're part of a fantasy football team, go and check out our player insights and factors that we have and grades and so on.
That's great, Aaron. Awesome. Well, we'll keep you posted. And for all you listeners, we'll keep you posted. And I guess, Aaron, as this continues to develop out, we'll have you back. I think it's fun having you on the show regularly because it feels like we get to see the iteration every time you come back on. And so it's cool seeing that happen.
Cool. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. So thanks for joining us. Aaron, Lauren, Chris, as a pleasure as always to have you on the show. And thanks to all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we will get you next week on Mixture of Experts.